He had made the mistake of telling her the truth, and she never let him forget it. Elaine set aside the spoon and drank from her coffee.
No argument there.
I hope she finally left him, said Frank. Not that she's any responsibility of mine.
It's not your responsibility that her husband, once he was healed up enough to go home from the hospital after the beating you gave him, beat her within an inch of her life?
Nope, absolutely not. I never laid a hand on her. We've been over this.
Uh-huh. And the baby she lost, said Elaine. That's not your responsibility either, right?
Frank sucked his teeth. He didn't know about any baby. It was the first time Elaine had mentioned it. She'd been waiting for exactly the right moment to ambush him. Some wife. Some friend.
Pregnant, huh? And lost the baby. Gee, that's a tough one.
Elaine fixed him with an unbelieving look.
That's what you call it? A tough one? Your compassion stuns me. None of it would have happened if you just called the police. None of it, Frank. He'd have gone to jail, and Candy Meeschaum would have kept her baby.
Guilt trips were Elaine's specialty. But if she'd seen the dog, what Fritz had done to it, she might think twice about giving him the stink eye. The Meeschaums of the world had to pay. It was the same with Dr. Flickinger. Which gave him an idea.
Why don't I go get the Mercedes man? He's a doctor.
You mean the guy who ran over that old man's cat?
Yeah. He felt really bad about driving so fast. I'm sure he'd help.
Did you hear any of what I just said, Frank? You go crazy, and it always backfires.
Elaine, forget about Fritz Meeschaum and forget about his wife. Forget about me. Think about Nana. Maybe that doc could help.
Flickinger might even feel he owed Frank for taking it out on his car instead of busting his way inside and taking it out on the good doctor himself.
There were more sirens. A motorcycle passed down the street, engine roaring.
Frank, I'd like to believe that.
Her speech, slow and careful, was intended to be sincere, but it was the same cadence Elaine adopted when she explained to Nana how important it was to keep neat drawers.
Because I love you. But I know you. We worked together for 10 years. You beat a man half to death over a dog. God knows how you handled this Flickmuller, or whatever his name is.
Flickinger. His name is Garth Flickinger. Dr. Garth Flickinger. Really, how could she be so dumb? Hadn't they almost been trampled or shot while trying to get a doctor to see their daughter? She drank down the rest of her coffee.
Just be here with your daughter. Don't try to fix what you don't even understand.
A dismal comprehension touched Frank Geary. Everything would be easier once Elaine was asleep, too. But for now, she was awake. So was he.
You're wrong, he said.
She blinked at him.
What? What did you say?
You think you're always right. Sometimes you are, but not this time.
Thank you for that wonderful insight. I'm going upstairs to sit with Nana. Come with me if you want, but if you go after that man, if you go anywhere else, we're done.
Frank smiled. He felt okay now. It was such a relief to feel okay.
We already are.
She stared at him. Nana's what matters to me now. Just her. 6. Frank stopped on the way to his truck to look at the woodpile by the back stoop. Hardwood he'd split himself. Half a cord left from the winter just passed. The little yodel stove in the kitchen made the place homey and welcoming in the cold weather. Nana liked to sit near it in the rocker, doing her homework. When she was bent over her books with her hair curtaining her face, she looked to Frank like a little girl from the 19th century, back when all these man-woman things were a lot simpler. Back then, you told a woman what you were going to do, and she either agreed or kept her mouth shut. He remembered something his father had told his mother when she protested over the purchase of a new power lawnmower. You keep the house. I'll make the money and pay the bills. If you got a problem with that, speak up. She hadn't. They'd had a good marriage that way. Almost 50 years.
No marriage counseling, no separations, no lawyers. There was a big tarp over the woodpile and a smaller one over the chopping block. He raised the smaller and pulled the hand axe free from the scarred wood. Flickinger didn't seem like much, but it never hurt to be prepared. 7. Dorothy went first, head lolling back, mouth open, dentures slipping slightly and flecked with cookie crumbs. She snored. The other three watched the white strings float and untether, split and float and fall down against her skin. They layered like bandages in miniature, wrapping in crisscross patterns.
"I wish..."
Margaret began, but whatever it was she wished, she didn't seem to be able to catch hold of the thing.
"Do you think she's suffering?" Blanche asked. "Do you think it hurts?"
Though her words felt heavy in her mouth, she herself was not in any pain.
"No."
Gail tottered to her feet, her library copy of Atonement dropping to the floor with a flap of paper and crinkle of plastic sheeting. She braced herself on the furniture as she crossed the room toward Dorothy. Blanche was hazily impressed by this effort. Along with the pills, they dispatched a bottle of Pinot, and Gail had drunk the most. There was an officer at the prison who competed in arm wrestling contests. Blanche wondered if there were contests for drinking wine and taking drugs and then walking around without tripping over the chairs or running into the walls. Gail might have missed her calling. Blanche wanted to express all this to Gail, but she found that the best she could do was,
"Nice walking, Gail."
She watched as Gail bent down close to Dorothy's ear, which was already layered in a thin coating of web.
"Dorothy, can you hear us? Meet me at the..."
Gail stopped.
"What place do we know is in heaven, Midge? Where should I have her meet us?"
Only Margaret didn't answer. Couldn't. The threads were now circling and knitting around her head, too. Blanche's eyes, seeming to move around of their own accord, found the window and the fire in the west. It was bigger now, not a match, but a flaming bird's head. There were still men to fight the fire, but maybe they were too busy taking care of their women to bother. What was the name of that bird, the one that changed into fire? Reborn, magic bird, scary, terrible. She didn't know. All she could remember was an old Japanese monster movie called Rodan. She had watched it as a child, and the giant bird in it had frightened her badly. She wasn't frightened now, just interested.
"We have lost my sister," Gail announced.
She had sunk to the carpet and was leaning against Dorothy's legs.
"She's just asleep," Blanche said. "You didn't lose her, honey."
Gail nodded so emphatically that her hair fell into her eyes.
"Yes, yes. You're right, Blanche. We'll just have to find each other. Just look for each other in heaven. Or, you know, a reasonable facsimile."
That made her laugh. 8. Blanche was the last. She crawled over to be near Gail, asleep beneath a layer of webbing.
"I had a love," Blanche told her. "Bet you didn't know that. We kept it, as the girls at the prison like to say, on the down low. Had to."
The filaments that lay over her friend's mouth stirred as Gail exhaled. One fine thread extended itself flirtatiously in Blanche's direction.
"I think he loved me, too, but..."
It was hard to explain. She was young. When you were young, your brain wasn't fully developed. You didn't know about men. It was sad. He had been married. She had waited. They had aged. Blanche had given up the sweetest part of her soul for a man. He had made beautiful promises and kept none of them. What a waste.
"This might be the best thing that ever happened."
If Gail had been awake, these words of Blanche's might have been too low and garbled for her to understand. feeling had left Blanche's tongue.
Because at least we're all together now, at the end.
And if there was something else, somewhere else. Before Blanche McIntyre could finish the thought, she drifted away. 9. Garth Flickinger wasn't surprised to see Frank. After having watched News America for the last 12 hours or so, and smoking everything in the house except for his pet iguana, Gillies, probably nothing would have surprised him. Should Sir Harold Gillies himself, that long-dead pioneer of plastic surgery, have come wandering downstairs to the kitchen to toast a cinnamon Pop-Tart, it would have barely pushed the envelope on the phenomena that Garth had witnessed on television that day. The shock of the violence that had broken out in Truman Mayweather's trailer while Garth was in the John was but a prologue to what he had absorbed in the hours since, just sitting on the couch. Rioting outside the White House, a woman gnawing off the nose of a religious cultist, a huge 767 lost at sea, bloodied nursing home orderlies, elderly women swathed in webs and handcuffed to their gurneys, fires in Melbourne, fires in Manila, and fires in Honolulu. Something very fucking bad had occurred in the desert outside Reno, where there was evidently some kind of secret government nuclear facility. Scientists were reporting on Geiger counters spinning and seismographs jerking up and down, detecting continuing detonations. Everywhere, women were falling asleep and growing cocoons, and everywhere, dumb fucks were waking them up. The wonderful News America reporter, Michaela, with the first-rate nose job, had vanished in the mid-afternoon, and they'd promoted a stuttering intern with a lip ring to take her place. It reminded Garth of a piece of graffiti he'd seen on some men's room wall. There is no gravity. The Earth just sucks. This sucked. In and out, back and forth, all the way around. Not even the meth helped. Well, it helped a little, but not as much as it should have. By the time the doorbell began ringing, cling-clong, cling-clong, went the chimes. Garth was feeling glaringly sober. He felt no particular urge to answer, not tonight, nor did he feel compelled to rise when his visitor gave up on the bell and began knocking. Then hammering, very energetic. The hammering ceased. Garth had time to think his unwelcome visitor had given up before the chopping began. Chopping and splintering. The door shuddered inward, broken free of its lock, and the man who had been here earlier strode in, an axe in one hand. Garth supposed the guy was here to kill him, and he didn't feel too sad about that. It would hurt, but hopefully not for too long. Plastic surgery was a joke to many people, not to Garth. What was funny about wanting to like your face, your body, your only skin? Unless you were cruel or stupid, there was nothing funny about it. Only now, it seemed, the joke was on him. What kind of life would it be with only half the species? A cruel and stupid life. Garth could see that right away. Beautiful women often arrived at his office with photographs of other beautiful women, and they asked, "Can you make me look like her?" And behind many beautiful women who wanted to tinker with their perfect faces were mean fuckers who were never satisfied. Garth didn't want to be left alone in a world of mean fuckers because there were so many of them. "Don't stand on ceremony. Come on in. I've just been catching up on the news. You didn't happen to see the part where the woman bit the man's nose off his face, did you?"
"I did," said Frank.
"I'm great with noses, and I enjoy a challenge, but if there's nothing to work with, there's not much you can do."
Frank stood at the corner of the couch a few feet from Garth. The axe was a small one, but still an axe.
"Do you plan to kill me?"
"What? No, I can't."
They were both distracted by the flat screen, where a news camera showed a view of a burning Apple store. On the sidewalk in front of the store, a man with a fire-blackened face moved around in a dazed little circle, a smoldering fuchsia handbag looped over his shoulder. The Apple symbol above the entrance of the store suddenly came loose of its moorings and crashed to the ground. A quick cut brought the viewing audience back to George Alderson. George's color was a wind-stripped gray, and his voice was gravelly. He'd been on all day. I just received a call from my, son. He went to my house to check on my wife. Sharon and I have been married for... The anchor dropped his head and traced the knot of his pink tie. There was a coffee stain on the tie. Garth thought this the most disturbing signal yet of the unprecedented nature of the situation. For 42 years now. Timothy, my son, he says... George Alderson began to sob. Frank picked up the controller from the side table and turned him off. Is your mind clear enough to understand what's going on, Dr. Flickinger? Frank indicated the pipe on the side table. Of course. Garth felt a tick of curiosity. You really aren't here to kill me? Frank pinched the bridge of his nose. Garth had the impression he was watching the outside of a serious internal monologue. I'm here to ask a favor. You do it and we're all square. It's my daughter. She's the only good thing in my life anymore. And now she's got it, the Aurora. I need you to come and look at her and... His mouth opened and closed a few times, but that was the end of his words. A thought of his own daughter, of Kathy, came to Garth's mind. Say no more, Garth said, snipping the thought off and letting it flutter away, a bit of ribbon in a stiff wind. Yeah? Really? Garth held out a hand. He might have surprised Frank Geary, but he hadn't surprised himself. There were so many things that couldn't be helped. Garth was always glad when he could. And it would be interesting to see this Aurora business up close. Of course. Help me up, would you? Frank got him on his feet, and after a few steps, Garth was fine. The doctor excused himself for a moment, stepping into a side room. When he emerged, he carried a small black case and a medical bag. They went outside into the night. Garth brushed his hand through the branches of the lilac tree protruding from the back left passenger window of his Mercedes as they went to Frank's truck, but refrained from comment. 10. The fox limped away from the grass fire the burning woman had started, but he carried a fire inside him. It was burning inside his lower back. This was bad, because he couldn't run fast now, and he could smell his own blood. If he could smell his blood, other things could as well. A few mountain lions still remained in these woods, and if one caught wind of his bloody back and haunch, he was finished. It had been a long time since he had seen a mountain lion, not since his mother was full of milk and his four littermates were alive, all dead now, one from drinking bad water, one from eating a poison bait. One taken in a trap that tore her leg as she squealed and cried. One disappeared in the night. But there were also wild pigs. The fox feared them more than the mountain lions. They had escaped some farmer's pen and bred in the woods. Now there were lots of them. Ordinarily, the fox would have had no problem escaping them and might have even enjoyed teasing them a bit. They were very clumsy. Tonight, though, he could hardly run. Soon he would not even be able to trot. The woods ended at a metal house that smelled of human blood and human death. Yellow strips hung around it. There were metal man-things in the weeds and lying on the crushed stone in front. Mixed in with the death sense was another, something he had never smelled before. Not a human smell, exactly, but like a human smell. And female. Putting aside his fear of the wild pigs, the fox moved away from the metal house. Limping and occasionally collapsing on his side while he panted and waited for the pain to subside. Then he went on. He had to go on. That scent was exotic, both sweet and bitter at the same time, irresistible. Perhaps it would take him to a place of safety. It didn't seem likely, but the fox was desperate. That exotic smell grew stronger. Mixed into it was another female smell, but this one was fresher and clearly human. The fox paused to sniff at one of Lila's shoe prints in the loam, then a patch of white stuff in the shape of a bare human foot. A small bird fluttered down to a low-hanging branch. Not a hawk, this time. This was a kind of bird the fox had never seen before. It was green. A scent drifted from it, humid and tangy, for which the fox had no context. It fluffed its wings self-importantly.
"Please don't sing," the fox said.
"All right," the green bird said. "I rarely do at night, anyway. I see you are bleeding. Does it hurt?"
The fox was too tired to dissemble. "Yes."
"Roll in the web. It will stop the pain."
"It will poison me," the fox said. His back was burning, but he knew about poison. Oh, yes. The humans poisoned everything. It was their best talent.
"No. The poison is leaving these woods. Roll in the web."
Perhaps the bird was lying, but the fox saw no other recourse. He fell on his side, then rolled onto his back, as he sometimes did in deer scat, to confuse his scent. Blessed coolness doused the pain in his back and haunch. He rolled once more, then sprang to his feet, looking up at the branch with bright eyes.
"What are you? Where did you come from?" the fox asked.
"The mother tree."
"Where is it?"
"Follow your nose," said the green bird, and flew off into the darkness.
The fox went from one bare-webbed footprint to the next, pausing twice more to roll in them. They cooled him and refreshed him and gave him strength. The woman's scent remained quite strong, that exotic, not-quite-woman scent fainter. Together they told the fox a story. The not-woman had come first and gone east, toward the metal house and the shed that was now burned. The real woman had come later, back-trailing the not-woman to some destination ahead, and then, later, returning to the stinking metal house with the yellow strips around it. The fox followed the entwined scents into a brushy break up the other side and through a stand of stunted fir trees. Tattered webs hung from some of the branches, giving off that exotic not-woman smell. Beyond was a clearing. The fox trotted into it. He trotted easily now, and felt he could not just run if one of those pigs showed up, but glide away. In the clearing he sat, looking up at a tree that seemed made of many trunks wrapped around each other. It rose into the dark sky higher than he could see. Although there was no wind, the tree rustled as if talking to itself. Here the not-woman smell was lost in 100 other traces of scent, many birds and many animals, none of which the fox knew. A cat came padding around from the far side of the great tree. Not a wild cat, it was much bigger. And it was white. In the dark, its green eyes were like lamps. Although the instinct to run from predators was bone deep in the fox, he did not move. The great white tiger padded steadily toward him. The grass of the clearing rustled as it bent beneath the dense fur of its belly. When the tiger was only 5 feet away, the fox lay down and rolled over, showing his own belly in submission. A fox might harbor some pride, but dignity was useless.
"Get up," the tiger said.
The fox got to his feet and timidly stretched his neck forward to touch the tiger's nose.
"Are you healed?" the tiger asked.
"Yes."
"Then listen to me, fox."
11. In her prison cell, Evie Black lay with her eyes closed and a faint smile on her lips.
"Then listen to me, fox," she said. "I have work for you."
Chapter 16. 1. Clint was about to ask Tig Murphy to buzz him out through the main door, but Assistant Warden Lawrence Hicks came buzzing in first.
"Where are you going, Norcross?"
The question sounded like an accusation, but at least it came out clearly. Although Lore Hicks looked disheveled, his hair a mussed halo around his bald spot, stubble on his jowly cheeks, dark circles under his eyes, the Novocaine from his morning dental procedure seemed to have worn off.
"To town. I need to see my wife and son." "Did Janice okay that?"
Clint took a beat to control his temper. It helped to remind himself that Hicks had either lost his wife to Aurora or would soon. That did not change the fact that the man standing before him was the last guy you wanted in charge of an institution like dueling in a time of crisis. Janice had once told Clint that her second-in-command had less than 30 credit hours of prison management from a degree mill in Oklahoma, and no hours at all in prison administration. "But Hixie's sister is married to the lieutenant governor," Janice had said. She'd had an extra glass of Pinot on that occasion, or maybe it had been two. "So you do the math. He's great at scheduling and checking inventory, but he's been here 16 months, and I'm not sure he could find his way to C-Wing without a map. He doesn't like to leave his office, and he's never done a single duty tour, although that's supposed to be a monthly requirement. He's scared of the bad girls." "You'll be leaving your office tonight, Hixie," Clint thought, "and you'll be touring, too, strapping on a walkie and making 3-wing rounds just like the other uniforms, the ones that are left." "Did you hear me?" Hicks asked now. "To Janice okay, you leaving?" "I have 3 things for you," Clint said. "First thing, I was scheduled out at 3 p.m., which was," he checked his watch, "about 6 hours ago. But, wait, here's the second thing. Warden Coates is asleep on her couch inside a big white cocoon." Hicks wore thick glasses that had a magnifying effect. When he widened his eyes, as he did now, they looked ready to fall out of their sockets.
"What?"
Long story short, Don Peters finally tripped over his own dick, got caught molesting an inmate. Janice canned his ass, but Don managed to load up her coffee with her prescription Xanax. It put her down fast. And before you ask, Don is in the wind. When I see Lila, I'll tell her to put out a bolo for him, but I doubt if it will be a priority. Not tonight. Oh my God. Hicks ran his hands through his hair, further disarraying what was left of it. Oh, my God. "Here's the third thing. We do still have the other 4 officers from the morning shift, Rand Quigley, Millie Olson, Tig Murphy, and Vanessa Lampley. You are number 5. You'll need to make midnight rounds with the others. Oh, and Van will bring you up to speed on what the inmates are calling super coffee. Jeanette Sorley and Angel Fitzroy are pushing it."
"Super coffee? What's that? And what's Fitzroy doing out? She's not trustworthy, not at all. She has anger issues. I read your report."
"She's not angry tonight, at least not yet. She's pitching in, like you need to. And if nothing changes, all these women are going to fall asleep, Lore. Every single one. Super coffee or no super coffee. They deserve some hope. Talk to Van and follow her lead if a situation comes up." Hicks grabbed Clint's jacket. His magnified eyes were panicky.
"You can't go. You can't desert your post."
"Why not? You did." Clint saw Hicks wince and wished he could have called those words back. He took Hicks's hand and removed it from his jacket, gently. "You checked on your wife. I need to check on Jared and Lila. And I will be back."
"When?"
"As soon as I can."
"I wish they'd all go to sleep,"
Hicks burst out. He sounded like a petulant child.
"Every last thieving, whoring, drug-taking one of 'em. We ought to give 'em sleeping pills instead of coffee. That would solve the problem, wouldn't it?"
Clint merely looked at him.
"All right."
Hicks did his best to square his shoulders.
"I understand. You have loved ones. It's just all this. All these women. We have a jail full of 'em."
"Are you just figuring that out?" Clint thought. Then asked Hicks how his wife was doing. He supposed he should have asked earlier, except hell, it wasn't as if Hixie had asked after Lila.
"Awake, at least so far. She had..."
Hicks cleared his throat, and his eyes shifted away from Clint's.
"She had some pep pills."
"Good, that's good. I'll be back. Doc?" It was Vanessa Lampley, a nod on the intercom. She was at his elbow in the hall by the main door. She had left the booth unmanned, a thing almost unheard of.
"You need to come and see this."
"Van, I can't. I need to check on Jared, and I need to see Lila." "So I can say goodbye," Clint thought. It occurred to him suddenly. The potential finality. How much longer could she stay awake? Not much. On the phone, she had sounded far off, like she was part of the way to another world already. Once she nodded off, there was no reason to believe she could be brought back.
"I understand," Vanessa said. "But it won't take more than a minute."
"You too, Mr. Hicks, sir."
This, I don't know, but this might change everything.
2.
Watch monitor 2, Van said when they reached the booth. 2 was currently showing the A-Wing corridor. Two women, Jeanette Sorley and Angel Fitzroy, were pushing a coffee trolley toward the soft cell, A-10, at the end. They stopped before they got there to talk to an extremely large inmate who for some reason had taken up residence in the delousing station.
So far, we've got at least 10 women asleep inside that webbing crap, Van said.
Might be 15 by now. Most in their cells, but 3 in the common room and 1 in the furniture shop. That shit spins out of them as soon as they fall asleep.
Except...
She punched a button on her console, and monitor 2 showed the interior of A-10. Their new intake lay on her bunk with her eyes shut. Her chest rose and fell in slow respirations.
Except for her, Van said. There was something like awe in her voice.
New fish is sleeping like a baby, and the only thing on her face is her camé-fresh skin.
Camé-fresh skin.
Something struck Clint about that, but it slipped away in his surprise at what he was seeing and his concern about Lila. She's not necessarily asleep just because her eyes are shut.
Listen, Doc, I've been doing this job longer than you've been doing yours. I know when they're awake, and I know when they're asleep. That one is asleep, and has been for at least 45 minutes. Somebody drops something, makes a clatter, she kind of twitches and then turns over.
Keep an eye on her. You can give me a full report when I get back, Clint said. I need to go. Despite Van's insistence that she could tell the difference between sleep and closed eyes, he wasn't sold. And he had to see Lila while he still had the chance. He didn't want to lose her with this, whatever it was, why she was lying, between them. He was out the door and heading for his car before the thing that had been bothering him finally coalesced in his mind. Evie Black had struck her face repeatedly against the wire mesh of Lila's cruiser, and yet only a few hours later, the swelling and bruises were entirely gone. Nothing where they'd been but camé-fresh skin.
3.
Jeanette drove the coffee wagon while Angel walked beside it, banging on one of the urns with the lid and yelling,
"Coffee! Special coffee! I got a peppy brew for all of you. Keep you leaping instead of sleeping."
They had few takers in A-Wing, where most of the cells were open and empty. Earlier in B-Wing, Ree's reaction had been a preview of what was to come. The special coffee might be a good idea, but hard to swallow. Ree had winced and handed her cup back after giving it a taste.
"Geez, Jeanette, I'll take a juice, but this is too strong for me."
"Strong to last long,"
Angel proclaimed. Tonight she had traded her normal southern accent for a maniacally perky ghetto patois. Jeanette wondered just how many cups of their special coffee Angel had ingested herself. She seemed to have no problem drinking it down.
"It's a power batch, so down the hatch. Unless you're a dummy, you want to end up a mummy."
One of the A-Wing women stared at her.
"If that's rapping, honey, I say bring back disco."
"Don't be dissing my rhymes. We're doing you a favor. If you ain't drinking, you ain't thinking."
But was postponing the inevitable really a good idea? Jeanette had thought so at first, roused by the thought of her son, but she was getting tired again, and she could sense hopelessness waiting right around the corner. And they weren't postponing the inevitable by much. When they brought their super coffee proposal to Officer Lampley, there had been 3 sleepers in the prison, but several more had gone since then. Jeanette didn't raise the issue, though. Not because she was afraid of Angel's famous temper, but because the idea of discussing anything was wearisome. She'd had 3 cups of the special coffee herself. Well, 2.5. Her stomach refused to take all of the 3rd cup, and she was still exhausted. It seemed like years since Ree had awakened her, asking if Jeanette had ever watched the square of light from the window as it traveled across the floor.
"I just can't be bothered with a square of light," Jeanette had said.
"I say you can't not be bothered with a square of light," Ree had replied.
And now this played over and over in Jeanette's mind like some crazy Zen koan.
can't not be bothered didn't make sense, did it? Or maybe it did. Wasn't there some rule about a double negative making a positive? If so, maybe it did make sense. Maybe...
Whoa! Hold up, girlfriend!
Angel bellowed, and gave the coffee wagon a hard butt shove. It rammed into Jeanette's crotch, temporarily bringing her wide awake. The special coffee sloshed in the urns and the juice sloshed in the pitchers. What? She asked. What the hell is it, Angel?
It's my homegirl, Claudia!
Angel shouted.
Hey, baby!
They were 20 feet or so up the A-wing corridor. Sitting slumped on a bench next to the Quell dispenser was Claudia Stevenson, known to all the inmates and the officers, although they did not use the nickname while in Gen Pop, as Claudia the Dynamite Badia. The bod in question wasn't quite as dynamite as it had been 10 months ago, however. Since her intake, starches and gallons of prison gravy had packed on 30 or 40 pounds. Her hands were resting on her brown uniform pants. The top that went with them lay crumpled at her feet, revealing an XL sports bra. Claudia's boobs, Jeanette thought, were still pretty amazing. Angel ladled coffee into a styrofoam cup, splashing some on the floor in her amped-up enthusiasm. She held the cup out to Claudia.
Drink it up, Ms. Dynamite! Made strong to last long! Powered by the hour, my sister!
Claudia shook her head and kept staring at the tile floor. Claudia? Jeanette asked. What's wrong? Some of the inmates were jealous of Claudia, but Jeanette liked her and felt sorry for her. Claudia had embezzled a great deal of money from the Presbyterian Church, where she had been director of services, in order to underwrite the ferocious drug habits of her husband and oldest son. And those two were both currently on the street, free as birds. I got a rhyme for you, Angel, Jeanette thought. Men play, women pay. Nothing's wrong. I'm just getting up my nerve. Claudia didn't take her eyes from the floor. To do what? Jeanette asked. To ask her to let me sleep normal. Like her. Angel winked at Jeanette, let her tongue loll from the corner of her mouth, and made a couple of circles around one ear with her finger.
Who you talking about, Ms. Dynamite?
The new one, Claudia said. I think she's the devil, Angel. This delighted Angel.
Devil Angel! Angel Devil!
She made scales in the air, lifted them up and down.
That's the story of my life, Miss Dynamite.
Claudia droned on. She must be some kind of wicked if she's the only one who can sleep like before.
I'm not getting you, Jeanette said.
Claudia raised her head at last. There were purple scoops under her eyes. She's sleeping. But not in one of those cocoons. Go see for yourself. Ask how she's doing it. Tell her if she wants my soul, she can have it. I just want to see Myron again. He's my baby and needs his mama. Angel dumped the cup of coffee she'd offered Claudia back into the urn, then turned to Jeanette.
We are going to see about this.
She didn't wait for Jeanette to agree. When Jeanette arrived with the coffee wagon, Angel was gripping the bars and staring in. The woman Jeanette had glimpsed while Peters assaulted her now lay loose-limbed on her bunk, eyes closed, breathing evenly. Her dark hair spread out in a glorious fan. Her face was even more beautiful up close, and it was unblemished. Not only was she clear of the webbing, the bruises Jeanette had seen were gone. How was that possible? Maybe she really is the devil, Jeanette thought. Or an angel come to save us. Only that didn't seem likely. Angels didn't fly in this place. Other than Angel Fitzroy, that was. And she was more of a bat.
Wake up!
Angel shouted. Angel, she put a tentative hand on Angel's shoulder. Maybe you shouldn't. Angel shrugged Jeanette's hand off and tried to roll the cell door, but this one was locked. Angel grabbed the lid of the coffee urn and began to wang it against the bars, creating an ungodly racket that made Jeanette slap her hands over her ears.
Wake up, biatch! Wake up and smell the motherfucking coffee!
The woman on the bunk opened her eyes, which were almond-shaped and as dark as her hair. She swung her legs down to the floor, long and lovely they were, even in her baggy intake coverall, and yawned.
She stretched her arms, thrusting forward a pair of breasts that put Claudia's to shame.
"Company!" she cried.
Her bare feet hardly seemed to touch the floor as she ran across to the bars and reached through them, grasping one of Angel's hands and one of Jeanette's. Angel instinctively pulled away. Jeanette was too stunned. It felt like some mild electricity was passing from the new woman's hand and into her own.
"Angel, I'm so glad you're here. I can talk to the rats, but they're limited conversationalists.
Not a criticism, just a reality. Each individual creature on its merits. My understanding is that Henry Kissinger is a fascinating discussion partner, yet consider all the blood that man has on his hands. Force me to choose? I'll take a rat, thank you, and you can print that in the newspaper. Just be sure you spell my name right."
"What in the hell are you talking about?" Angel asked.
"Oh, nothing really. Sorry to blabber. I was just visiting the world on the other side of the world. Scrambles my brains a little to go back and forth. And here's Jeanette Sorley. How's Bobby, Jeanette?"
"How do you know our names?"
Angel asked.
"And how come you can sleep without growing that shit all over you?"
"I'm Evie. I came from the tree. This is an interesting place, isn't it? So lively, so much to do and see."
"Bobby's doing fine," Jeanette said, feeling as if she were in a dream, and perhaps she was. "I'd like to see him again before I fall asleep." Angel yanked Jeanette back so hard she almost fell.
"Shut up, Jeannie. This ain't about your boy."
She reached into the soft cell and grabbed Evie by the admirably filled front of her coverall.
"How are you staying awake? Tell me you're all put a hurtin' on you like you never had. I'll make your cunt and your asshole swap places."
Evie gave a jolly laugh.
"That would be a medical marvel, wouldn't it? Why, I'd have to learn how to go to the bathroom all over again."
Angel flushed.
"You want to play with me? You want to? You think just because you're in that cell, I can't get at you?"
Evie looked down at the hands on her. Just looked. But Angel screamed and staggered back. Her fingers were turning red.
"Burn me! Bitch, burn me somehow!"
Evie turned to Jeanette. She was smiling, but Jeanette thought there was sadness as well as good humor in those dark eyes.
"The problem is more complex than it first might appear. I see that. I do. There are feminists who like to believe that all the world's problems go back to men, to the innate aggressiveness of men. They have a point. A woman never started a war, although, trust me, some were definitely about them. But there are some bad, bad chickadees out there. I can't deny it."
"What is this shit you're spouting?"
She looked back to Angel. "Dr. Norcross has his suspicions about you, Angel. About the landlord you killed in Charleston, for one thing."
"I didn't kill nobody."
But the color had drained from Angel's face, and she took a step backward, bumping the coffee wagon. Her reddened hands were pressed to her chest. Evie redirected to Jeanette, speaking in low tones of confidence. "She's killed 5 men. 5. And now she turned again to Angel. "It was a kind of hobby for a while there, wasn't it, Angel? You out hitchhiking to nowhere in particular, with a knife in your purse and a little .32 in the side pocket of that rawhide jacket you always used to wear. But that's not all, is it?"
"Shut up. Shut up!"
Back to Jeanette, those amazing eyes went. Her voice was quiet but warm. It was the voice of a woman in a television ad, the one that told her friend that she also used to have problems with grass stains on her children's pants. Only this new detergent had changed everything. She got pregnant when she was 17, covered it up with big loose layers of clothes, hitchhiked to Wheeling, didn't kill anyone that time, good for her, and took a room, had the baby.
"Shut up, I said!"
Someone with a video monitor had taken note of the confrontation. Rand Quigley and Millie Olson were pounding down the corridor, Quigley with mace in hand, Olson with a taser set on medium power. "Drowned it in the sink. Dropped the body down the incinerator chute." Evie grimaced, blinked a couple of times, and added softly, "Pop goes the weasel." Quigley tried to grab Angel. She whirled instantly at his touch, threw a punch, and overturned the cart, coffee, juice, and all. A brown wash, no longer scalding but still hot, poured over Millie Olson's legs. She screamed in pain and fell on her behind. Jeanette watched in amazement as Angel went full Hulk Hogan on Quigley, grasping his neck with one hand and clawing away the mace with the other. The can hit the floor and rolled through the bars of the soft cell. Evie bent, picked it up, offered it to Jeanette.
"Want this?"
Jeanette accepted it, unthinkingly. Officer Olson was paddling around in a brown puddle, trying to get out from under the overturned coffee wagon. Officer Quigley was trying to keep from being choked out. Although Angel was skinny and Quigley outweighed her by at least 50 pounds, Angel shook him like a dog with a snake in its jaws and tossed him into the coffee wagon just as Millie Olson was getting up, and they went down together with a thump and a splash. Angel whirled back to the soft cell, her eyes huge and glittering in her narrow little face. Evie spread her arms as wide as the bars would allow and held them out to Angel, like a lover beckoning her beloved. Angel held her own arms out, her fingers bent into claws, and rushed at her, screaming. Only Jeanette saw what happened next. The two officers were still trying to untangle themselves from the overturned coffee wagon, and Angel was lost in a world of fury. Jeanette had time to think, "I'm not just seeing bad temper. This is a full-blown psychotic episode." Then Evie's mouth yawned open so widely that the entire bottom half of her face seemed to disappear. From her mouth came a flood of moths. They swirled around Angel's head, and some caught in the peroxided upspout of her hair. She screamed and began to beat at them. Jeanette rapped Angel on the back of the head with the can of mace. "I am going to make an enemy here," she thought, "but hey, maybe she'll go to sleep before she can come back on me." The moths flew toward the caged overhead lights of A-Wing and into the main prison. Angel turned, still tearing at her head, although all the insects in her hair now seemed to have joined their fellows, and Jeanette triggered the mace directly into the screaming woman's face.
"You see how complex the problem is, don't you, Jeanette?"
Evie said, as Angel blundered into the wall, howling and furiously rubbing her eyes.
"I think it might be time to erase the whole man-woman equation. Just hit delete and start over. What do you think?"
"That I want to see my son," Jeanette said. "I want to see my Bobby."
She dropped the can of mace and began to cry. 4. While this was happening, Claudia, the dynamite Badia Stevenson, emerged from the delousing station and decided to seek climes more serene and vistas new. "Just too noisy in A-Wing this evening. Too upsetting. That special coffee was spilled everywhere, too, and it smelled really bad. You didn't want to go and attempt to parley with the devil when your nerves were jumbled. That was common sense." She could talk to the lady in A-10 later. She passed the booth and walked into B-Wing. She left her top behind. "Inmate!" Van Lampley leaned out of the booth where she had seen the fight about to break out. Angel with her fucking super coffee. Van was too bush to castigate herself, but she should never have consented to the plan. She had sent Quigley and Olson to defuse the situation and was about to rush out to join them when Stevenson passed through. Claudia made no reply, just kept walking. "You forgot something, didn't you? This is a prison, not a strip joint." "Talking to you, Stevenson. Where do you think you're going?" But did she, Van, really care? Lots of them were wandering now, probably just trying to stay awake. And meanwhile, there was a fuckery going on down at the far end of A-Wing. That was where she was needed. She started that way, but then Millie Olson, splashed with coffee all down her front, waved her back. "Under control," Millie said. "Got that crazy bitch Fitzroy locked up. Situation back to normal." Van, thinking that nothing was under control and nothing was normal, nodded. She looked around for Stevenson and didn't see her. She returned to the booth and called up the first floor of B-Wing on one of the monitors, in time to see Claudia entering B-7, the cell occupied by Dempster and Sorley. Only Sorley was still in A-Wing, and Van hadn't seen Dempster in quite a while. Inmates were not above a bit of petty theft if they found a cell empty. The favorite targets of opportunity were the two P's, pills and panties, and such depredations inevitably caused trouble. She didn't have any reason to suspect Claudia. who was no nuisance in spite of being big enough to cause plenty of hassle, would do such a thing. Nonetheless, it was Van's job to be suspicious. It wouldn't do to have a rhubarb break out over a case of stolen property, not with everything else that was going wrong. Van decided to make a quick check. It was just a feeling, but she hadn't liked the way Claudia was walking, with her head down, her hair in her face, and her smock top cast off God knew where. It would only take a minute, and she could stand to stretch her legs, get the blood flowing again. 5. Claudia didn't have theft on her mind. All she wanted was a bit of calm conversation. It would pass the time until A-Wing settled down and she could speak to the new woman and find out how she, Claudia, could also go to sleep and wake up like on any other day. The new woman might not tell her, but then again, she might. The devil was unpredictable. He had been an angel once. Rhee was on her bunk with her face turned to the wall. Claudia noted for the first time, and not without pity, that Rhee's hair was starting to turn gray. That was true of Claudia as well, but she dyed hers. When she couldn't afford the real stuff, or when none of her few visitors could be persuaded to bring her some Nutrice Champagne Blonde, her favorite, she used real lemon from the kitchen. It worked pretty well, but didn't last very long. She reached out to touch Rhee's hair, then jerked back with a little cry when some of the gray stuck to her fingers. The threads wavered in the air for a second or two, then melted away to nothing.
"Oh, Rhee," Claudia mourned. "Not you, too."
But maybe it wasn't too late. There were only a few strands of that cocoon stuff in Rhee's hair. Maybe God had sent Claudia to B7 while there was still time. Maybe this was a test. She took Rhee by the shoulder and rolled her onto her back. The webbing was spiraling out of Rhee's cheeks and her poor, scarred forehead. Strands of it were emerging from her nostrils and eddying in her breath, but her face was still there. Well, mostly. Claudia used one hand to begin scrubbing the crap from Rhee's cheeks, going from one side to the other, not neglecting the whitish threads emerging from her mouth and strapping themselves across her lips. With her other hand, Claudia grabbed Rhee's shoulder and began to shake her. "Stevenson?" from down the hallway. "Inmate, what are you doing in there? That's not your cell."
"Wake up!"
Claudia cried, shaking harder.
"Wake up, Rhee, before you can't!"
Nothing. "Inmate Stevenson, I'm talking to you."
"That's Officer Lampley,"
said Claudia, still shaking and still scraping at the relentless white threads. God, it was hard to stay ahead of them.
"I like her, don't you? Don't you, Rhee?"
Claudia began to cry.
"Don't go away, honey. It's too soon to go away."
And at first she thought the woman on the bunk appeared to agree with that, because her eyes snapped open and she began to smile.
"Rhee,"
Claudia said.
"Oh, thank God. I thought you were..."
Only the smile continued to spread, the lips drawing back until it wasn't a smile at all, but a teeth-baring snarl. Rhee sat up and clamped her hands around Claudia's neck and bit off one of Claudia's favorite earrings, a little plastic kitten face. Claudia screamed. Rhee spat out the earring along with the attached scrap of earlobe and went for Claudia's throat. Claudia outweighed the diminutive Rhee Dempster by 70 pounds, and she was strong, but Rhee had gone insane. Claudia was barely able to hold her off. Rhee's fingers slipped from Claudia's neck, and her fingernails dug into the larger woman's bare shoulders, bringing blood. Claudia staggered from the bunk and toward the open cell door, Rhee clinging to her like a limpet, snarling and gnashing and jerking from side to side, trying to break Claudia's hold on her so she could move in and do real damage. Then they were in the hall, and inmates were shouting. Officer Lampley was bellowing, and those sounds were in another galaxy, another universe. Because Rhee's eyes were bulging, and Rhee's teeth were chomping inches from Claudia's face, and then, oh God, her feet tangled, and Claudia went sprawling in the B-Wing corridor with Rhee on top of her.
"Inmate!"
Van shouted.
"Inmate, let loose!"
Women were screaming. Claudia did not, at least to begin with. Screaming took strength, and she needed hers to hold the lunatic, the demon, away from her. Only it wasn't working. That snapping mouth was closing in. She could smell Rhee's breath and see drops of Rhee's spittle with tiny white filaments dancing in each drop.
Inmate, I have drawn my weapon. Don't make me fire it. Please don't make me do that.
Shoot her!
Someone screamed, and Claudia realized the someone was her. It seemed she had enough strength after all.
Please, Officer Lambley!
There was a huge bang in the hallway. A large black hole appeared high in Ree's forehead, right in the middle of the grid of scar tissue. Her eyes swiveled up as if she were trying to see where she'd been shot, and warm blood spattered across Claudia's face. With a final galvanic effort, Claudia pushed Ree away. Ree hit the corridor with a limp thud. Officer Lampley stood with her legs braced and her service weapon held out before her in both hands. The smoke curling from the muzzle reminded Claudia of the white threads that had stuck to her fingers when she had brushed Ree's hair. Officer Lampley's face was dead pale, save for the purple pouches under her eyes.
"She was going to kill me," Claudia gasped.
"I know," Van said.
"I know."
Chapter 17 1 Halfway to town, Clint Norcross had a thought that caused him to pull into the lot of the Olympia Diner and park beside the easel sign reading, "My oh my, try our egg pie." He pulled out his phone and searched Hicks. He didn't have his number, which said everything about his relationship with Dueling Correctional's assistant warden. He scrolled further and found Lampley. Lampley picked up on the second ring. She sounded out of breath. "Van, you okay?"
"Yeah, but you left before the fireworks. Listen, Doc, I had to shoot someone."
"What? Who?"
"Ree Dempster. She's dead."
Van explained what had happened. Clint listened, aghast. "Jesus," he said when she was finished. "Are you all right, Van?"
"Physically unhurt, emotionally fucked to the sky, but you can psychoanalyze me later."
Van made a vast, watery honking sound, blowing her nose on something.
"There's more."
She told Clint about the violent confrontation between Angel Fitzroy and Evie Black.
"I wasn't there, but I saw part of it on the monitors."
"Good thing you did. And Claudia, sounds like you saved her life."
"It wasn't a good thing for Dempster."
"Van,
I liked Dempster. If you'd asked me, I would have said she was the last woman in here to go postal."
"Where's her body?"
"In the janitor's closet."
Van sounded ashamed.
"It was all we could think of."
"Of course." Clint rubbed his forehead, eyes squeezed shut. He felt he ought to say more to comfort Lampley, but the words weren't there. "And Angel, what about her?"
"Sorley, of all people, got hold of a mace can and blasted her. Quigley and Olson bull-rushed her into a cell in A-Wing. She's currently beating on the walls and yelling for a doctor. Claims she's blind, which is bullshit. She's also claiming there are moths in her hair, which might not be bullshit. We've got an infestation of the bastards."
"You need to get back here, Doc. Hicks is having a meltdown. He asked me to surrender my weapon, which I refused to do, even though I suppose it's protocol." "You did the right thing. Until things settle down, protocol's out the window." "Hicks is useless." "Don't I know it," Clint thought.
"I mean, he always was, but under these circumstances, he could actually be dangerous."
Clint searched for a thread. "You said Evie was egging Angel on. What exactly was she saying?"
"I don't know, and neither do Quigley or Millie either. Sorley might. She was the one who slowed Angel's roll. Chick deserves a medal. If she doesn't crash out, you can get the whole story from her when you come back. Which will be soon, right?"
"ASAP," said Clint. "Listen, Van, I know you're upset, but I need to be clear on one thing. Angel started in on Evie because Evie wasn't in one of those cocoons?"
"That's my sense. I just saw her whacking on the bars with a lid from one of the coffee urns and yelling her head off. Then I had my own fish to fry."
"But she woke up."
"Yeah."
"Evie woke up."
"Yeah. Fitzroy woke her up."
Clint tried to make something coherent of this and couldn't. Maybe after he got some sleep himself. The idea caused a flush of guilt to heat his face. A wild idea came to him. What if Evie Black was male? What if his wife had arrested a guy in drag? But no. When Lila arrested her, Evie had been buck naked. Presumably the female officers supervising her intake had seen her that way, too. And what would explain all her bruises and scrapes healing in less than half a day? I need you to pass on what I'm about to say to Hicks and the other officers who are still there.